To order, the time is 3:18 on Tuesday, March 24th, 2026, and we're here in room 120. Please mute cell phones today. Members present are Representative St. Clair, Representative Vance, Representative Holland, Representative or Vice Chair Story, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary is Cecilia Miller, and our moderator from the Juno LAO is Renzo Moises. Our committee aide for today's hearing is my staff, Stuart Relay. We have six items on today's agenda. We will start by finishing our work on House Bill 152 from Representative Galvin's office, establishing a education head tax and income tax. We will then go to House Bill 295 on PFD eligibility for pilots from Representative McCabe, taking up amendments and looking to the will of the committee. And after that, we have House Bill 189 on PFD convictions overturned from Representative Mears, again, taking up our amendments and looking to the will of the committee. And then, as time allows, we will do our very best to get to House Bill 235 on PFAS from Representative Hall for a first hearing. We may just take public testimony today and set the more thorough introductory presentation aside for a later date. And then we have House Bill 214 from Representative Galvin as well that we began to discuss last week. We do have to stop sometime between 5 and 5:10 today. So just as a reminder, please keep comments concise today so we can try to get to as much as possible on our agenda. The first item on today's agenda is House Bill 152, the education head tax proposal from Representative Galvin. This is our seventh hearing on the bill, and today the intention is to complete the amendment process we started last Thursday and look to the will of the committee. Let's go ahead and jump right into it. I'd like to welcome Representative Galvin and her staff to the table. And we had left off at amendment number 10, and there were two amendments remaining. Both were from my office. One had been previously drafted. The other amendment was a conceptual amendment we had discussed at our previous hearing, following an amendment that Representative Vance had offered. And I do have that language written out now and confirmed, so we'll offer it as a conceptual amendment, but we do have clear language for what to offer. And I'd also like to welcome Representative Himshute. So at this time, we will go ahead and jump into amendment number 10. And I will move amendment number 10, also known as A.12, and object for discussion so that folks can bring it up and I can describe it. Amendment number 10 adds a deduction for property taxes paid by individuals for their primary residences. Property taxes are, as we know and as we discussed in this committee, something that can be very burdensome for Alaskans, especially those that are in communities who rely almost exclusively on property taxes or rely on them as their primary source of revenue, like in Fairbanks and Anchorage. And so this amendment allows Alaskans to deduct their property taxes from their income tax, thereby reducing the overall tax burden on Alaskans. I'd also like to have the record reflect that my office investigated adding a sales tax deduction as well off of the local sales tax rates that are existing in some communities. But we didn't find an efficient way to accomplish this goal. You run into a lot of potential even IRS issues and administrative issues, and it just really wasn't something that we could figure out a way to firmly calculate and then deduct. And it would be very costly for the Department of Revenue to implement and would cause large cost drivers on this bill administratively. So we decided to forego something to that effect, although I did want to note that we discussed that in committee as well, and we did try to look into doing that. This amendment before us here is in response to the tax burden that was illustrated in the report that was prepared by Representative Galvin's office and her staff, and it was a very comprehensive report. And that is amendment number 10. I'll open it up for discussion, and maybe I could start with if the bill sponsor has a comment on this amendment.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Chair Carrick. So this amendment is looking to allow for deduction of property, and that is in – so the way the bill is written is that technically you can – typically that would be part of your adjusted gross income. And so you'll be able to take your federal taxable income and use that amount in order to determine what your base amount is to be taxed or not taxed, whatever the case may be. So it is typically part of adjusted gross income. However, I talked to Ledge Legal about this, and they mentioned that we can't know how folks will fill that out. And sometimes there will be mistakes. So this would help, I think. This would be a positive amendment in that if folks don't fill that out properly, they will be able to see this as an option in case they missed it, in case there was an oversight.
Great. Thank you, Representative Galvin. Representative Holland.
Thank you. I think to the maker of the motion, but perhaps also to the bill sponsor, I just wanted to follow up on the last comment because I was looking at this trying to figure out if this was essentially a double deduction in there, because to the degree that somebody has filled out their taxes and itemized their deduction, they've already deducted property taxes. To the degree that they don't itemize, they get a standard deduction, which already covers a great number of things. And I know in my case now, the standard deduction is large enough that some years it's big enough to cover my property taxes and everything else I might have itemized. So this looks like it might, for most people, allow you to essentially be deducting your property taxes twice. And I don't know if that's, I'm interpreting it wrong, or if that's not the case in there. But since it's taken off of adjusted gross income as a part of standard deductions, and then we get to take it off again, seems like it's coming out twice.
Might see if Representative Galvin has a response.
Yeah. It is not permitting you to double dip in terms of your deductions. It is permitting you to include it if you forgot to put that in your federal tax form. So, and this is from Ledge Legal, and I agree with them. That makes sense. I said, well, I don't understand. Why is this in here? And what they said was, well, we can't control how Alaskans are going to fill out their form. And if this language, I mean, I'm going to try to get to the notes exactly. It is already built into the federal income tax form, but you never know how people are going to file their taxes and whether they are going to include or exclude local property tax from their federal AGI. So if it's neglected, to remove the local property tax and it's calculated in the federal AGI, then they can still deduct this in their state income taxes.
Follow up.
So just to thank you for the clarification, but to make sure that I'm clear, if they did include it in their federal taxes, does this allow them to still deduct it again? Or
no.
Is this one or the other?
It's my understanding is that the way this is interpreted, according to Ledge Legal, there is no double deduction, according to Ledge Legal, and no harm in doing this amendment.
Great. Thank you.
And I appreciate that, Representative Holland. We had asked that to just to want to make sure we're still capturing revenue in this legislation and so trying to strike a balance there. And they had said the same thing to our office.
Great. Thank you. So.
I'd like to know Representative McCabe joined us at 3:26 p.m. Is there any additional discussion on Amendment Number 10? Seeing and hearing none, I'm going to remove my objection. And seeing and hearing no further objection, Amendment Number 10, also known as A.12, is adopted. And so, as I mentioned at the beginning of the hearing, that was the conclusion of all of the previously prepared amendments. At our last hearing on Thursday, we did discuss the opportunity for a conceptual amendment, and we had called Ledge Legal and gotten language for that. We have since called Ledge Legal and confirmed some more specific language so that we adopt something clear for technical and conforming changes. And what I'll do is I will offer the conceptual amendment and object to it so that I can restate that discussion from last Thursday. So at this time, I offer conceptual amendment number One to House Bill 152, which on page 2, line 7, following education, inserts and technical and vocational education. Following education on page 22, line 9, inserts and technical and vocational education. On page 22, line 11, following 4, inserts 1. On page 22, line 12, following AS 14.03.420, inserts and 2, technical and vocational education programs. I'll object to the conceptual amendment and start the discussion by saying this conceptual amendment is being offered in response to the committee's discussion around the amendment that Representative Vance had offered, which was amendment number 8, also known as A.10, and essentially adds to anywhere in this legislation where we are designating funds for education, that we are also specifying that technical and vocational education may be included. So it's education and technical and vocational education in there. Let's make sure I got everything from my talking points. And just to add, you know, I just agreed with Representative Vance's desire to offer that amendment, and I believe this kind of gets at the intent from that previous amendment in the component where that was discussed. And I would just ask for the committee support, and I'll ask maybe if Representative Galvin has a comment.
No, just that I have no objections. Thank you.
Is there any additional discussion on this amendment? Representative Hemshoot.
Super technical question, but as a general rule, to the chair, we say career and technical education versus technical and vocational education. Is there a difference? I think I should know that, and I don't.
You know, Representative Hemshoot, you and Vice Chair Story are probably much more experts on that than I am. I don't think I see, if it helps for the record to clear up, that I don't necessarily see a difference. I know for the technical and vocational education program that Representative Vance had originally referenced, that the program is named after technical and vocational education. That's where I chose to use that language. But if there's a clearer way to put this, I'd be happy to withdraw and restate the motion.
I think, Chair Carrick, I think it should be fine. I just want to say that my understanding is technical and vocational education is another term for career and technical education. To me, they are synonymous, in which case I'm fine with this amendment. But I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't missing something.
I think from my perspective, I would see them as synonymous too, for what it's worth for the record to say that. Representative Holland.
Yeah, thanks. I just was going to comment. If we go back 20 years ago, we generally referred to it as vocational education. And then sometime in my world around 2002, 2003, there was a change in the lexicon that updated vocational education to career and technical education. So this is kind of just a mashup of what are separately two very common terms at this point. So I think it's probably clearly understood. But
thanks for that context. Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. My comment just was, I think you changed it because in Rep. Vance's amendment, she wanted the money to go to TVAP, Technical Vocational Education Program. And from what I understand, your amendment was just to any career technical program being offered. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Yeah. I just wanted to clarify that. It's not to the TVAP program that was in Vance's. Yeah. It's just in Career Tech.
No, yeah. Thank Career you. Tech. Yeah. Thank you for thank that you. Clarification, Vice Chair Story. And just to be really clear, this is just generally adding the words technical and vocational education, as opposed to trying to designate funds to a specific statutorily designated program. I do feel like that gets a little too complicated. And I've also had stated last week, I have some challenges with the current TVET program. So I don't really want to designate more funding to it from this mechanism at this time. So Representative Vance.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for this amendment and really finding a way to just, you know, capture the ideas that we definitely want it to go to K through 12, but also the full education that we need to help Alaskans students stay here in the state and work and develop the state into its next future. So I think this does this nicely. And, you know, if it, as it moves through the process, they have a better way to word it. I don't know that anyone in this room is going to have their feelings hurt because it's capturing the idea that we need to make sure that we prioritize the education for the jobs that are on the horizon and really gearing up towards everything that Alaska needs. So thank you for adopting this.
Is there any additional discussion? Seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection to the conceptual amendment. Seeing no further objection, conceptual amendment number one has been adopted. And this brings us to the underlying House Bill 152 as amended. And I'd like to welcome Representative Galvin to make any brief concluding statements, if you have anything you'd like to say.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. The primary thing I wanted to express is gratitude. I appreciate that the state may or may not be ready yet to consider broad-based revenue, but to have this discussion and to help Alaskans understand what it might look like and how it might affect their pocketbook, how it might affect state services, how it might affect the state's credit rating. All of these things are really important for us in our long-term fiscal planning. And so I appreciate each of you for your contributions to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Galvin. And is there any additional discussion on this legislation? Representative Vance.
Well, I just want to thank the bill sponsor in being bold and bringing forward, you know, a challenging topic. And you have stayed true to, you know, what you want to prioritize and you value in our budget. And I admire that. But respectfully, I'm going to keep my word to my district. And I'm going to oppose this legislation because my district very, very clearly said no to an income tax. Conversations have said that they like the idea of the education head tax, which is an interesting thought that I need to have a fuller conversation with my district about just that, because it is a separate topic. It's similar by nature. But it is very different than an income tax that people, especially in our struggling economy right now. So I think there's further conversation to be had with our districts back home. But unfortunately, this is something that I am not able to support. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Is there any additional discussion? Representative St. Clair and then Hemshoe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To caveat off of what Representative Vance said, again, it's bold bringing this forward. You're starting the conversation. You and I have had discussions about what I do and what I don't like about the bill. I don't, again, my constituents do not want any taxation. I see in your flyer here you kind of talked about designated funds and then went further to say UGF, but I get hung up on any mention or marketing this as an education tax because it can be used for anything. But I appreciate that you did put that in your flyer. As I stated before, everyone pays the $150 head tax, and then only 27% of working Alaskans would actually be impacted by this tax. And again, this, I'm not telling you anything that we haven't had a conversation about earlier. And I won't be voting for the bill, but I appreciate you getting the conversation out. You and I have sat down several times and discussed this. I appreciate you bringing it up. And I'm not going to stop it from leaving committee. I don't think I can, but it'll go on to the next one. So thank you.
Representative St. Clair, Representative Himshue.
Thank you, through the chair, I guess, to the sponsor. I just wanted to point out how many deeply respected long-term residents of my district have brought up the head tax over and over and over again. They have said, we used to pay an education head tax and it came out of your first paycheck. I thought that meant the January paycheck for everyone in the state. But it was, if you came into the state and you got a job in June, out of your first paycheck came the whatever, $10 or whatever it was. And they loved that. It felt purposeful to them. And so these are people that I have so much admiration for because they've been here for a very long time and they all remember it. And no one has said, I wish we weren't still doing that. So I really appreciate that aspect of the bill. Thank you.
Excellent. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Just a couple brief comments. I think echoing the appreciation of the sponsor bringing this bill forward. I would just note, I think, three quick things. One is I really value the head tax discussion because it's a way of ensuring that we all are part of paying some taxes at this point. And I think that aspect of this bill was really important. Second is I've had a lot of folks in my district that have been essentially saying, you know, we need to increase our tax base so we can afford the education that we want. And if you were at the Anchorage Town Hall a couple weeks ago, we had quite a few folks that stood up and said, tax me. People want the services. They understand they need to pay for them and they want to be responsible and be a part of that. All that being said, the final comment is that one of the things that I've, you know, done that is kind of, you know, tried to thread the needle on this issue is that I, on one hand, want to defend the PFD. And one of the ways we defend the PFD is to broaden our income so that we're not having to essentially take the PFD away as a way of taxing everybody. And that's what we've been doing. It's been applied to everybody across the state. It has had to cut that dividend off of the income. And from my standpoint, this income tax is a way to redistribute and diversify our source of income. And one of the benefits is it takes the pressure off of having to take away the PFD in order to try and balance the books, because we won't agree to any other tax except to take away the PFD amount. So I appreciate the effort on this. I look forward to continuing to work with people on this, including some of the ideas brought forth in the amendment process to try and figure out how do we, you know, move this into place in a way that minimizes disruption, because I know a lot of people are struggling with bills.
Thank you, Representative Holland. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I know how we do it. We cut the budget. But thanks for bringing us forward. I appreciate the discussion for sure, but it needs to include a budget cut, or at least a, or in addition to capping the amount of money that we can spend. We, us, here in this building. So that's how we do it.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair to the committee and the sponsor, thank you for bringing this forward. I think Rep. McCabe just now was basically talking about elements of a fiscal plan. And I know, I believe that is something that we all are working on and discussing, and I appreciate your bill helping us with that discussion. So I hope it brings further discussion about that as it moves through the process. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story. Since we've all gotten a chance to comment, I guess I will add, you know, when this bill was first brought forward, the bill sponsor put this forward as a component of a potentially 3- to 4-legged stool, which would include controlled spending. It might include changes to current oil tax structures or other tax structures on industry. It might also include consistent, predictable PFD amounts through discussion about formula changes. And between the members of this committee and members in our body, we have all of those components of proposals available to discuss. And I appreciate where everybody comes from and their where they fall on this particular bill. Just want to reiterate, it does take some amount of courage to step forward and bring forth a bill with a T word in it. And Representative Galvin, the fact that you've done that and the comprehensive work your staff has done on talking about this issue is really, it's really valuable. And I hope that even if Alaskans watching this really don't like this bill, that they will take some time to look at its components and just think in a different way about some of the consistent challenges we have. And I thank the committee for doing that too, because I think we've all really spent some time on this and done that, and respect where everybody falls in that conversation. Vice Chair Story, can I have a motion, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee move House Bill 152, also known as 34-LS0674, /A, as amended from committee, with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authorizing legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
And there is an objection, and I think we've all kind of spoken to where we're at, so I'm just going to ask for the clerk to please call the roll on House Bill 152.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative McCabe.
No, thank you.
Representative St. Clair.
No.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Hemshoot.
Yes.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
4 yeas, 3 nays.
With a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, House Bill 152 has passed the committee. We're going to take a very brief at ease to sign the paperwork. We have to get right back into the agenda, so don't go anywhere, committee members. State Affairs is back on the record, and the next item on our agenda today is House Bill 295 relating to PFD eligibility from Representative McCabe. This is our fourth hearing on this bill. At our hearing on Tuesday, March 17th, I set an amendment deadline for Wednesday, March 18th at 5 p.m. We did receive 3 amendments. We are joined today by PFD Division Director Genevieve Wojtusik for questions, I think online. But it's my intention that we will hop right into amendments, and I will have the sponsors of each amendment offer them, and then offer Representative McCabe as the bill sponsor an opportunity to comment on them. The first amendment is amendment number 1, also known as A.1, from my office. At this time, I'm going to move amendment number 1 and object for discussion. So amendment number 1 offers a excusable absence for flight attendants who have a certificate of demonstrated proficiency from the FAA. And we did do some research into this from my office. This is a certificate that's required by the FAA for all flight attendants on U.S. Airlines. It's a pretty standard language that would cover all flight attendants in Alaska in this legislation. I did want to note that this amendment is very similar to Amendment 3 from Representative Vance. And while I don't really want to get into the specifics of that amendment till we get to it, I would just note for committee members that these two amendments are not contradicting each other. One is more comprehensive than the other, the later amendment. This one is more specific, but we did ask Ledge Legal about potential conflicts with adoption of both, and there's not a conflict with adopting both. So in my opinion, this amendment is a targeted, tight definition that covers these critical personnel in our airline community. And so that's why I offered amendment number 1. I guess we'll go to Representative McCabe first.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. Yeah, I don't have any objection to this, but I would like to apologize to flight attendants everywhere for not including them in the first bill, lest I not get my meal on time. But in any case, I'm afraid pilot. I didn't fly with flight attendants much in my airline, so I just didn't say pilots. And my mistake, but I appreciate you bringing the amendment forward so that we can be all inclusive in this committee. So thanks.
Awesome. Thank you, Representative McCabe. And you better watch out, because you don't want to make the staff unhappy.
So I haven't traveled since we did this.
Is there any other committee discussion? Seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection. Seeing and hearing no further objection, amendment number 1, also known as A.1, has been adopted. And this brings us to amendment number 2, Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I move amendment 2.
Just object for discussion, Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So this is just a technical conforming amendment to 295. It's pure housekeeping. The legislative legal flag that the original bill added pilot absence in A.7 or A.17, but missed updating subsection B. The amendment adds a new section after page 4, line 6, extending the 6-month prior residency rule to A1 through 17 and renumbers as needed. There's no substantive change whatsoever by this amendment. It simply closes a minor drafting gap to ensure full consistency across the statute. If there's any questions about the necessity, I think hopefully Alpheus from Ledge Legal is on, Alpheus Bullard is online.
He is not, but I'll just see if, is there any discussion on amendment number 2? We also, my office did look into it as well, and this is a technical change that is beneficial for the bill. So I will remove my objection. Is there any additional objection on amendment number 2? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number 2, also known as A.2, has been adopted. And this brings us to amendment number 3, Representative Vance.
I move amendment number 3, A.4.
And I will just, again, object for discussion. Representative Vance.
This amendment builds on the committee's prior action recognizing flight attendants and ensures the bill fully aligns with federal aviation law by covering any flight crew member who was required by the FAA for specific operation. In real-world aviation, especially in Alaska, safe operations and often involve more than a pilot or a certified flight attendant. Depending on the aircraft or type of operation, federal law may require additional crew members. Those individuals are legally required for that flight and are part of the operational flight crew. This amendment ensures that statute tracks those federal requirements and we don't leave anyone out who we need to make sure is instrumental in helping us get here and there, and that they don't miss out on receiving their PFD.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Is there any additional committee discussion? Representative McCabe?
Thanks, Chair Carrick. I have no objection to this amendment, so I appreciate the maker of the amendment bringing this forward.
Same. I just will add that I see this as the overall umbrella that covers the everybody in the flight crew world. The original bill was pilots. This bill includes all crew. The amendment we previously passed was flight attendants specifically, but they are also covered under this language more broadly. And just also would encourage members to support it. Is there any additional discussion? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection. And seeing and hearing no further objection, amendment number 3, also known as A.4, has been adopted. With no further amendments before the committee, House Bill 295, as amended, is back before the committee. Is there any final discussion on House Bill 295? Hearing and Representative Holland.
Well, thank you to the chair. I'm not sure what our next step is going to be, but I guess I'll just take this opportunity to say I support what this bill is doing, and I'll support this bill moving on. But I just do want to note, because I've been contacted by constituents about other areas where the new requirements that PFD eligibility is tied to hunting and fishing, things we talked about, other folks have said, me too, me too. Just as today we offered some amendments that went beyond pilots to a few other folks are saying, well, I've got a job that takes me out of state. You know, how do I get an amendment in for what I'm doing? And had a situation with some military folks that have another little carve out that's not quite covered by the existing rules saying, how do I get in there? And I just think that we've got a general growing issue, particularly as we now attach this to hunting and fishing. We make this really personal for folks about the impact. It's not just a PFD check they're missing now. Now they're missing something that's really important to their livelihood, to their history of growing up, their access to subsistence fishery. So like I said, I'll support this bill moving on or wherever it goes next. But I just want to highlight for all of us that we've kind of opened up a question of how do we deal with this long term? Because there's other well-justified Alaskans that are living their lives here but have careers that take them out and about for a while. And I just foresee us getting an increased tangle. I would have liked to, with the encouragement of some of my constituents, to add a couple more pieces onto this one. But we agreed to kind of keep this focused in on pilots for the moment and the flight crew. So I respect that and kind of was, you know, stood down on making some more changes. But the fact is there's a bigger, broader issue here of folks we'll be hearing from, I think, as they fully learn about the changes that we made on the hunting fishing side of it. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holland. Any additional discussion? I'll just also add, you know, I respect Representative Holland that there are a lot of professions that probably we have never really thought about, that none of us here maybe have ever worked in or have represented, but it is an outstanding issue. And I do think in the future, maybe there will end up needing to be some more comprehensive solutions. But at this time, given the momentum on other similar legislation from the last few years, and just given the pervasiveness of this particular profession and this issue, that it feels valuable that we move forward with this bill today. Seeing no further discussion at this time, I will ask Vice Chair Story for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee move House Bill 295, also known as 34-LS1376/A, as amended from committee with attached fiscal notes, individual recommendations, and authorizing legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
And hearing and seeing no objection, House Bill 295 has moved from the House State Affairs Committee. We're going to, again, take a very brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Please don't leave. We're going to hop right into our next bill. At ease. House State Affairs is back on the record, and the next item on our agenda is House Bill 189 on PFD convictions overturned from Representative Mears. This is our third hearing on this bill. At our last hearing, I set an amendment deadline for Wednesday, March 18th at 5 p.m. We received no amendments. We are joined today by our Nancy Mead at the Alaska Court System, our trusty Alaska Courts personnel, and online, or in the room rather, by, again, our Permanent Fund Division Director. I'd like to welcome Representative Mears and her staff to the committee table. Do you, as the bill sponsor, Representative Mears, have any final comments on the bill?
I thank you very much, Chair Carrick, and the committee for hearing this. We've looking forward to providing at least some restoration of state services to folks that have been improperly incarcerated, and look forward to this bill moving forward.
Thank you, Representative Mears. At this time, I am going to ask Vice Chair Story for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee move CS for House Bill 189, also known as 34-LS0895/N, from committee with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authorizing legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
Object.
Representative St. Clair, would you wish to speak to your objection?
Just briefly, I've already made it known to the bill sponsor the concerns I have with this and the indeterminate fiscal note, so I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. Is there any additional committee discussion on House Bill 189? Seeing and hearing none, the objection is maintained.
I'll remove my objection.
Very brief at ease. Bill 189 has been removed. Seeing and hearing no further objection, House Bill 189, version N, has been moved from committee. And we will again take an at ease to sign the paperwork on this bill. And please, again, stick around. At ease. Back on the record, and the next item on today's agenda is House Bill 214 on motor vehicle proof of insurance from Representative Galvin. This is our second hearing on the bill, and today we are going to take public testimony and have probably brief today continued committee discussion. For the moment, we're going to go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill 214. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on House Bill 214? Seeing none, we'll go online. Looks like we might have somebody named Taffy Montalvo. Are you here to testify today on House Bill 214?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Taffy Montalvo. I'm from Alaska, and my family's homestead's in Talkeetna, and I now live in Illinois. I've been paying the high cost of SR-22 insurance for 10 years now. I've made mistakes in my past when I was young and irresponsible back in 2012 when I got into a wreck without insurance and received an unsatisfied judgment against me for not paying the debt in 30 days. However, over the past 12 years, I've allowed God to transform my life for the better. In 2016, I entered into a payment arrangement for my judgment, acquired SR-22 insurance, paid my DMV fines, and got my license back. In 2022, I paid off my debt and satisfied the judgment, but when I called the DMV to ask about removing the SR-22 requirement, that's when I found out Alaska state law requires one to pay SR-22 for the rest of their life, even if their judgment is satisfied. In 2023, I started emailing the legislation in regard to this law. The only other time SR-22 is required for life is if somebody's had 4 DUIs. I find it hard to believe that having one unsatisfied judgment, a financial penalty, carries the same great penalty as that. Another thought is, due to the high cost of SR-22 insurance and a lifetime requirement, there's a risk that people who can't afford it will drive without any insurance at all. I believe the law was put in place around 1959, and it's in need of a revision. This is a law with no second chances, and I believe people deserve that. Thank you so much for listening to me today.
Thank you, Ms. Montalvo, for your testimony. I don't see anyone else online for testimony, so I guess I'll open it up once more if there's anyone online or in the room for public testimony on House Bill 214. Seeing and hearing none, at this time we are going to close public testimony on House Bill 214. And is there additional committee discussion on this bill? Brief at ease. State Affairs is back on the record, and I'll open it up one more time. Is there additional committee discussion on this bill today? Seeing none, I am setting an amendment deadline for House Bill 214 today for Monday, March 30th at 5 p.m., and we will be setting House Bill 214 aside today until our hearing early next week. Thank you, Representative Galvin and staff, for being here. So the next item on our agenda today is House Bill 235 on PFAS, which I'm sure we'll get the full acronym spelled out for us on that one, from Representative Hall. Today we have an introductory presentation as well as invited and public testimony noticed. I'm going to ask the bill sponsor to present the bill, and then we are going to jump right into public testimony since it was noticed for today, and we do have some folks online and in the room to public for public testimony, and then we will come back as we have time to additional committee discussion. Very brief at ease. State Affairs is back on the record, and I'd like to welcome Representative Hall and her staff, Maya Narong, to House State Affairs. Please put yourselves on the record and begin with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to present HB 235 to the House State Affairs Committee. Good afternoon. My name is Carolyn Hall. I represent House District 16, which includes the West Anchorage neighborhoods of Turnigan, Spinard, and Sand Lake. With me is my staff carrying the bill is Ms. Maya Narong. So if it pleases the committee, I'd like to just present a brief overview before transitioning to the sectional, if that's the will of the chair.
That sounds great. Thank you, Ms. Narong.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. PFAS started being used to manufacture household items in the 1940s and 50s. Over the last 70 years, PFAS, also known as forever chemicals, have infiltrated just about every aspect of our lives, from rainware and waterproofing spray to nonstick cookware and clothing to cosmetics and dental floss. What is PFAS and why do we care? PFAS is used in products that resist heat, stains, grease, and water. They are toxic and designed not to break down, hence the name forever chemicals. There are over 12,000 PFAS compounds, and medical research reveals that PFAS is linked to health issues such as hormone disruption, lower birth weight, obesity, thyroid disease, breast cancer, kidney cancer, testicular cancer, liver damage, and many more. In Alaska, the primary source of PFAS contamination in drinking water is PFAS-containing aqueous film-forming foams, or AFFF. These foams are used during firefighting and fire training activities and are commonly found at airports and military installations. So if committee members have an airport or a military installation in your district, chances are you are likely to have a PFAS contamination. Because PFAS are the forever chemicals they were designed to be, they persist in the environment and are soluble in water, where large plumes of groundwater contamination can form, where the PFAS have been released. When releases occur in areas served by private or public drinking water wells, the well water is susceptible to contamination. I represent House District 16, which, as I mentioned, includes parts of the Turnigan, Spinard, and Sand Lake neighborhoods in Anchorage, and all three of those neighborhoods border the Ted Stevens International Anchorage Airport. The Department of Conservation tested and found PFAS contamination in five sites on the airport campus. At Eielson Air Force Base, DEC is monitoring 48 locations with active PFAS contamination, and at J-Bear, DEC is monitoring 26 locations with active PFAS contamination. Other locations across Alaska where DEC has found PFAS contamination or is monitoring for PFAS contamination include Homer, Yakutat, Sitka, Gustavus, Petersburg, Ukiagvik, Nome, Bethel, Cold Bay, and just south of Anderson. There are plenty of other locations, too, beyond that list that I just mentioned. If passed, HB 235 would conform Alaska statute to the National Primary Drinking Water Regulation set by the EPA in 2024. It would require DEC to, at a minimum, annually test all public water systems for PFAS, and if contamination levels exceed health-based limits, the department must provide safe drinking water to affected residents. HB 235 would also clarify liability for the costs associated with testing drinking water and, if necessary, replacement. The state would not bear the cost of testing or replacing drinking water if the party responsible failed to comply with applicable laws, regulations, or manufacturer instructions, or if the party did comply and PFAS were still released, then the manufacturer would be liable. Lastly, HB 235 would establish permitting standards for facilities designed to thermally remediate PFAS contamination. And Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'd like to turn it over to my staff for the sectional.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Hall.
Thank you.
For the record, Maya Narong, staff to Representative Hall. Thank you, Chair Carrick and members of the State Affairs Committee. I will go through the sectional now. Section 1 amends AS 46.03 by adding new subsections addressing annual testing for PFAS levels in public water supply systems, liability for responsible parties or manufacturers that release PFAS into public water systems, the provision of safe drinking water in cases of contamination, and permitting the thermal remediation of PFAS. Section 1 also defines PFAS and provides safety metrics for the contamination levels. Section 2 applies a new subsection 46.03.350, which addresses the liability for the release of PFAS retroactively. Section 3 indicates that Section 2 takes immediate effect, and Section 4 provides an effective date of January 1st, 2027. And if there are no questions here, I'll go right into the presentation.
Excellent. Sounds good.
And I will, just to start off, please excuse my pronunciation of these many really hard to say chemical names. So what exactly are PFAS? Perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances are man-made forever chemicals that are harmful to people in the environment. These compounds have a carbine fluorine bond, which is one of the strongest type of bonds that chemicals can have, which is why they're really slow to degrade when they're in our environment. There are more than 12,000 different PFAS compounds used in products since the 1940s. And to name again some of those things that they're in: carpets, upholstery, wax, paint, coatings, firefighting foam, all sorts of things that are just in our daily lives, probably, that you are using have PFAS in them. Production facilities, waste disposal sites, and wastewater are examples of ways that PFAS are getting into our drinking water supply. I want to note that this legislation defines PFAS to include six substances, with the option for DEC to regulate others not listed specifically in the statute. And these include perfluoroketonic acid, perfluorosulfonic acid, perfluoroanionic acid, perfluorohexosulfonic acid, perfluorobutane sulfonic acid, and hexafluoropropylene oxide dimer acid.
We're going to give you a trophy for that.
And you will never have to hopefully hear me say all of those again. So on April 17, 2024, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced the designation of two types of PFAS, the perfluoroketonic acid and perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, as hazardous substances under the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. And on September 17th of 2025, EPA announced its intent to retain these this designation. Scientific studies have shown that exposure to PFAS in the environment may be linked to harmful health effects in humans and animals, including cancers, impacts to the liver and heart, and immune and developmental damage to infants and children. And it's, I think, important to note that infants who drink formula are particularly at risk for some of these developmental conditions, because formula is often mixed with water. If it's contaminated water supply, then infants are taking in a lot of contamination out of, you know, during that really critical developmental stage of their life. So this graphic highlights some of the main health effects studies have shown to be linked to PFAS contamination. So the solid lines you'll see on this graph here are things that we know with pretty high certainty to be effects of PFAS. And those with the dotted lines are ones that they are still continuing to do research into, but we so far have shown to be linked. I'm mostly going to skip over this slide since it's just a snapshot of what the bill does. And I think that between the sectional and the rest of the presentation, we cover it. But this slide, if you are looking back at this later, covers essentially all of Section 1 of the bill. So this map from DEC shows the contamination sites they're currently tracking. And you can see there's many green rhombuses indicating active PFAS contamination. And if we were to zoom in on airports and the military bases around the state, you see a significant cluster all grouped together. So according to today, according to the GIS system, there are 490 sites across the state being monitored for PFAS. HB 235 would require DEC to annually test all those public water systems. And then if contamination levels exceeded the provided health safety levels provided in the bill, then they would be required to provide safe drinking water to affected residents. So two charts here. The chart on the left is the health safety limits that are being added in this bill. I can attempt to read all these again if you really want, but I think we can read or attempt to read them. And we took these guidelines from the 2024 EPA guidelines. For reference, in just the amount of PFAS we're talking about, 4 parts per trillion is about equivalent to 1 drop of water in 5 Olympic swimming pools. So it's very, very small amounts of chemical is really hazardous already. So the last row on that left table is a little weird. The hazard index is what they use when we have multiple PFAS that are being mixed together in your contamination system. It's not pure. And the hazard index has been a EPA standard for addressing different types of toxic hazard levels. And so what they do is they divide the measured concentration of the substance by the health-based value associated with it, and then you add all the fractions together. And if that addition of the compounds together is equals 1 or higher, then you are above the cutoff concentration for safe water. HB 235 also adds a liability for PFAS contamination. It holds that if a person fails to comply with any laws, regulations, or instructions regarding the use and disposal of PFAS and then were to release PFAS into the environment, they are liable for the cost of testing their drinking water and providing safe drinking water. If a person did comply with all the relevant laws, regulations, and instructions, and their product is still causing a PFAS release, then the manufacturer would be liable for these costs. So this would not fall on the state. And this liability that is added to statute is applied retroactively to any PFAS releases that happen before its effective date. And lastly, HB 235 requires DEC to issue a thermal remediation permit to facilities that use thermal remediation treatment processes to address PFAS. A permit will not be issued or could be revoked if the remediation process results in the release of fluorinated chemicals into the air. What makes PFAS so pernicious is that the hydrogen fluorine compound, as I said, has a really strong bond and it's high connectivity. And because they don't degrade well in the environment, if we're releasing those back into the air, they're just falling right back down into the environment. And in which case, the remediation process has not really done its job of removing them. And that is what I have. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Hall, did you also want to walk through a sectional at this first hearing, or would you like to go to invited testimony?
Madam Chair, I think going straight to invited testimony would suffice.
Okay. I think that's what we'll do. We have time to do invited and public testimony. So we'll start with our invited testimony and we'll just ask our testifiers, if possible, if you can keep your testimony to somewhere between 5, no more than 10 minutes. That would be excellent. Our first testifier today is Pam Miller, who I believe is joining us online. Yes. Ms. Miller, if you could please put your name and affiliation on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair Carrick, Vice Chair Story, and members of the House State Affairs Committee for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 235, a bill that is necessary to safeguard public health by establishing health protective and enforceable drinking water standards for PFAS. My name is Pamela Miller, and I serve as Executive Director and senior scientist with Alaska Community Action on Toxics. We are a nonprofit environmental health research and advocacy organization. We believe that HB 235 is necessary to protect public health. Alaska currently uses outdated guideline levels that are set much too high and not reflective of current science and epidemiology. These guideline levels are not enforceable. We know that harmful exposures to PFAS have devastating consequences for people's health as well as our businesses and economy. As noted, PFAS are known as forever chemicals because they are highly persistent and bioaccumulate in the bodies of fish, wildlife, and people. PFAS exposures are linked with harmful health effects at extremely low exposure levels. These include liver damage, immune suppression, decreased fertility, decreased birth weight, certain cancers, pregnancy-induced hypertension and preeclampsia, increased cholesterol, and increased risk of thyroid disease and other endocrine disorders. These adverse health effects and long-term harms are significant to Alaskans because PFAS are and have been contaminating the drinking waters of vulnerable communities from the North Slope to Southeast. People may have been exposed to dangerous levels of PFAS for decades because the state has not enacted enforceable standards, and the state guidelines are set at levels that are exceedingly high, and again, based on antiquated science. There are no safe exposure levels to certain PFAS. Currently, there are 519 sites in Alaska where PFAS contamination has been identified in soil and or water, according to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. PFAS contaminate fish, wildlife, our garden produce, backyard chickens, and people. Several lakes, particularly in interior Alaska, are close to fishing because of PFAS contamination. And in our own testing, we have found significant levels in PFAS, of PFAS contamination in all of the waters that we've measured in and around the Fairbanks North Star Borough, as well as in the Anchorage area. The ADEC lacks a systematic and comprehensive monitoring program to investigate the nature and extent of PFAS contamination in Alaska. Regulations at the federal level have been rolled back, thus making it even more important for states to take the lead in protecting the health of our residents. Failure to act puts people at long-term health risk. We respectfully request that the House State Affairs Committee pass HB 235 so that it can be passed expeditiously by the full legislature during this session. Thank you again for your kind consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Miller, and we really appreciate you calling in for testimony. If you could just stay on the line for committee discussion after our testimony, that would be great. We also have a second testifier, Brittany Robbins, who is here in the room with us. If you'd like to come up and put yourself on the record and begin with your invited testimony.
Thank you, Chair Carrick, Vice Chair Story, and committee members. My name is Brittany Robbins. I live in Wrangell, Alaska. I'm a lifelong remote Alaskan. I am the Civic Engagement Coordinator at Alaska Community Action on Toxics, but today I am testifying on behalf of myself. I'm going to start out with a little timeline. First grade, so age 7, severe migraine disorder. Age 12. First, stomach ulcers and high cholesterol. Age 14, endometriosis. Age 23, fibromyalgia. Age 27, preterm labor followed by diagnosis of severe Crohn's disease and severe ulcerative colitis. 28, rheumatoid arthritis. 38, hysterectomy and adenomyosis. All of these conditions are connected to PFAS. I spent my summers at my grandparents' house on 74th and Lawrence in Tacoma, Washington, directly next to McCord Air Force Base. This is currently a known contamination site for PFAS and PTFE. These illnesses are chronic, and although I can treat the symptoms, there's no such thing as a lifelong treatment. Most of the treatments that we are given for these different autoimmune disorders are what they call biologics, meaning there's actual living cells within the treatment. So your body either becomes allergic to it or begins to reject it or becomes immune as it would with many other things. I spend about $20,000 a year out of my own pocket for transportation to hospitals and treatments for these conditions. I will never know what it's like to quote unquote feel good. Every time I get a virus or an infection, I'm at high risk of being put in the hospital. Since 2012, I have not gone a single year of my life without being hospitalized for something. Something that likely you wouldn't be hospitalized for example, strep throat or influenza. I'm only 41. And I get hospitalized every single year for something. All because I spent the summers going to my grandparents' house, drinking their water, and eating the fruits and vegetables from my grandmother's big, beautiful garden. Those are some of my most fond memories. And I find the sound of airplanes comforting because of the planes flying in and out of McCord during the night when I was young. I didn't know then what would happen to me later in life. Every single person in my family that grew up in that home have one, at least one, if not multiple autoimmune conditions as well. My father lost his colon at the age of 35. My aunt, his youngest sister, lost her uterus and her colon, full hysterectomy, full colectomy by the age of 19. She now only has the organs in her body that are required for living, and even some of them, she doesn't have the full organ. When she was in her late 30s to early 40s, I can't remember her exact age, she came down with an incredibly rare breast cancer that has absolutely zero genetic ties. She also has had a double mastectomy. She's basically a living shell because of exposure to these chemicals. So I want to thank you again for hearing this bill today. I want to thank Representative Hall for bringing this bill forward. It's incredibly personal to me. It is a reason why I do the work that I do. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Robbins, for your testimony and for sharing the personal story that you have for you and your family. Really appreciate you being here. At this time, we are going to open public testimony on House Bill 235. And we will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on House Bill 235? Seeing none, we'll come back to the room in a second. Online, we have Heather Kopanen in Fairbanks. Welcome, Heather.
Good afternoon, and thank you, representatives, for your service on this committee. My name is Heather Kopanen, Fairbanks. I am very concerned about the spread of the PFAS, and as you heard, it's spreading all over the state. It's spreading to more communities and affecting more people, including me, where we found that it was in our well several miles out of Fairbanks. And I have found that I had an incurable autoimmune disease that's very rare, in which my cartilage attacks, my body attacks my cartilage, and also some of the other conditions that are related to PFAS exposure. With PFAS in the groundwater, it's undesirable to drill a well to irrigate farming on a piece of land I own and which has some people who want to farm it. And you know that we have food security issues. We need to grow more of our own. I sent an email today to you folks on the committee with a link for funding from EPA. I know that some of you are very concerned about fiscal note. So thank you for working for us, the people of Alaska.
Thank you, Ms. Kopanen, for giving us a call today and for testifying. Do we have anyone else for testimony on House Bill 235? I see Owen Jappen in Washington, D.C. Are you here for testimony?
Yes, good afternoon.
Okay, please go ahead and put yourself, please go ahead and put your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony.
Wonderful, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Carrick, members of the State Affairs Committee. My name is Owen Jappen, and I serve as Director of Chemical Products and Technology at the American Chemistry Council, or ACC. ACC is a national trade association headquartered in Washington, D.C., representing more than 190 companies engaged in the business of chemistry. Our members produce the chemistries and materials essential to a wide range of products and industries that support modern life, including healthcare, manufacturing, infrastructure, and consumer goods. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on House Bill 235 today. Given the U.S. EPA's final National Primary Drinking Water Regulation, or NPDWR, for PFAS, the state of Alaska can reasonably limit PFAS monitoring requirements to situations where concentrations exceed the federal maximum contamination level, or MCL. While EPA's current approach established MCLs of 4.0 parts per trillion for PFOA and PFOS, and 10 ppt for PFHXS and PFNA and HFPODA, dimer acid or Gen X, the agency has signaled that they may wish to withdraw these designations, at least for PFHXS, PFNA, and HFPO dimer acid. Recognizing that the MCLs are somewhat in flux, other states in similar situations, including Illinois, have incorporated MCLs by reference in their entirety, as opposed to naming each MCL individually, as the proposed bill does today. A similar approach in Alaska would be appropriate and coherent, and prevent a patchwork of regulations across the country if EPA were to modify or change its approach. Because EPA's MCLs are federally enforceable thresholds designed to prevent adverse health effects aligning with Alaska's monitoring requirements, these federal levels ensure regulatory consistency, avoid unnecessary testing burdens for public water systems when PFAS levels pose no demonstrated health risk, and direct resources towards systems most in need of mitigation. These target approaches support the goal of public health protection while maintaining regulatory efficiency and clarity for public water systems. To accomplish this, ACC proposes a set of amendments, which we will submit in writing, which include a handful of strike-throughs of relevant text and recommended replacement text. We thank you again for the opportunity to provide the testimony today, and appreciate the committee's time and consideration for our perspective on House Bill 235. Thank you again.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jappen. And I don't see anybody else online for public testimony. I'll go just one more time to see if there's anybody in the room for public testimony on House Bill 235. Seeing none, we are going to close public testimony on House Bill 235. And the bill is back before us for general discussion at this time. I just wanted to note we have a few folks here with us or online. We have Shondi Perry, who's the director of the Division of Environmental Health, Jean McCabe, the director of the Division of Water, and Teresa Melville, the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response at DEC, in addition to our invited testifiers and our bill sponsors. And it also looks like we have Melanie Bray, our PFAS coordinator at DOT. So those are all of our folks that are available. Do we have committee discussion on House Bill 235? Representative St. Clair and then Holland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who direct this to. It's probably the bill sponsor. The question, a couple of the questions that I have is, without HB 235, is Alaska out of conforming with federal regulation?
Welcome back, Representative Holland.
Sorry, I should have warned them first.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative St. Clair, I'd like to defer to the science and scientists and expertise of Ms. Miller.
Thank you.
Ms. Miller, did you hear that question?
Yes, thank you. Through the Chair, I would say that right now there are no enforceable drinking waters at the federal level because they were rolled back during this current administration, and the state does not have enforceable drinking water standards. And as I mentioned in my testimony, the guideline levels that the state uses at 70 parts per trillion for two PFAS, PFOS and PFOA, are set much too high because the current science shows that there is no safe level of exposure, and the EPA scientifically established levels in 2024 demonstrated and indicated that there was a maximum contaminant goal of zero because it is known that there's virtually no safe level of exposure.
Okay, thank you.
That answers your question.
Yes, ma'am. And I'll leave my questions at there, as we're short on time.
Thank you, Representative St. Clair. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the Chair, first question has just been answered. That was very helpful. So thank you for that clarification. Two other just clarifications I wanted for now. One is with regard to the thermal remediation section on page 3, I was just curious, the work that I've been around on thermal remediation has two general kind of approaches. One is concentration and one is actual destruction of the PFAS and other related chemicals. And I'm curious, reading through this quickly, it's not clear whether this is applying to all thermal techniques or this is just destruction or concentration. I'm just curious about the scope of the certification or licensing that's being offered under this section with regard to concentration versus destruction.
Through the Chair to this is Maya Narang for the record, through the Chair to Representative Holland. My understanding is this would be for all thermal remediation processes, and the only way a license would not be given or a permit would not be given or would be revoked would be if whatever process that entity is using is releasing more PFAS into the environment, which in either, I believe, concentration or destruction is not the goal.
Okay. Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
And then the other just clarification question for today is on the liability portion. I didn't see, but perhaps I missed any language about responsibility to clean up contamination. It looked like if it was discovered, there was some responsibility for testing and for supplying clean water, but I didn't notice how that responsibility might flow to somebody to be responsible for actually trying to recover and clean up the contamination, and who carries that cost.
Representative Holland, through the Chair, can you please repeat the question?
Yeah, thank you. Through the Chair, on the slide and the section that deals with the liabilities of the manufacturers and the parties responsible for a spill, I see that it outlines a responsibility for testing in some cases and supply of fresh water, but I didn't see any description of responsibility to actually clean up the contamination. Who bears that cost?
Representative Holland, through the chair. This is Representative Hall for the record. At this point in the bill stage, that is not outlined in the piece of legislation. And if you have thoughts and ideas to amend this, I would certainly take that as a friendly amendment.
Thank you. All right, we have Vice Chair Story and then Representative Himshu.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. And my questions and comments are similar to Rep. Holland's. Right now, it seems that the current process that we have in place does not match the time frame of people's lives and who is the responsible party for acting in an expedited manner to help. I represent Gustavus, and the state has been supplying drinking water and building cisterns, but what I would like to see in this bill and have some language for is it's really something that it's language about when it's considering emergencies and fast tracking cisterns being built, things like that, when we know this is needed. And right now, right now we do have an RFP out for these cisterns to be finished in Gustavus, but it has taken months to get to that point, and the RFP's ready, still not going out, and we're talking months. And I would be interested in having some sort of language about emergency situations when things have been identified that are hazardous and people are waiting, that somehow we would fast track that. I understand, and I've seen the fiscal note for this bill, that it costs money to do that. But it seems like, you know, at what level we're talking about people's lives, as we've heard. So that is a big question in my mind, how to address that. I just know it's very important. I'm going to be looking for some sort of language to address something like that. And I know and I appreciate the slide that showed all the sites around our state where there was PFAS identified. Is there kind of some kind of a summary page about how many sites and the ones these have all exceeded the current standard set by DEC and federal regulations? Is that correct? And they're now doing testing?
So through the chair, Representative Story, firstly, I really appreciate your comments about including language as far as when it should be considered an emergency. I've been familiar with the Gustavus situation for a number of years. I know it's been highly, highly problematic there, and it continues to remain an issue. So I'm very open to having additional language inserted into the bill when it comes to what is determined as an emergency. Secondly, you brought up the fiscal note, and I knew going in that it was going to have not only more than one fiscal note, but that it was probably going to be borderline excessive. And I will also say that this bill is also borderline audacious, and we have to start somewhere when it comes to addressing these PFAS forever chemicals that are seeping into our water supply. Thirdly, you asked about the graphic that is on the screen right now before the committee, and this map is accessible through the DEC website. We're happy to provide a link for it. And this map in particular shows a mixture of sites that DEC is monitoring or has found active PFAS contamination, or it shows a level of cleanup that DEC has managed. So it's a variety of things based on the legend and the shapes that you see at all those different locations. But the website, it's a GIS mapping website, and it's really interesting just to poke through, and you can dial right in to see where specifically the monitoring is taking place. And there's a slew of information as far as who the point of contact is for it. What stages is it in? Is it informational, meaning it's being monitored, or is it an active site. And so we're happy to share that with the committee.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Representative Holland. I've seen that, particularly in Gustavus, and been able to pull that up. I am wondering if you have an idea about how much the state spent to provide drinking water to those communities that are in that current phase of the requirements that we have to fix the firefighting foams is basically what happened in the Gustavus area. I would just be curious, and I don't expect you to have it right now, but as we move through this, it would just be interesting to see what we're spending on it now and about what we're spending for testing. And at some point here from the department, I realize that we have the deputy commissioner here today, and I appreciate that. But it would be kind of nice to know the size of the problem that we are dealing with as we work through this bill. And then if I had one more follow-up at this point anyway.
One more follow-up.
Sure. Thank you for that indulgence. When we're talking about the process of thermal remediation and how it breaks down the chain, and you were talking about, you mentioned it early, it breaks it down and then it can go into the air via plume up there in the atmosphere. Do we have any idea of, at this point, of how we can address that and prevent that damage? Is there anything in science or something that you're aware of?
Through the chair, Representative Story, I do not have the answer to that, but I believe Ms. Miller online should be able to help address your question. Additionally, I appreciate your comments about scoping the size of the problem and especially the funding that is going towards it currently. I think that's really important information to have. Additionally, it'll be interesting to compare what the cost of addressing the PFAS in this situation or in these types of situations that we find ourselves in compared to healthcare costs, such as what Ms. Robbins was bringing up earlier. And with the increased healthcare costs that all of us are facing, what would be cheaper to address the PFAS, to keep these, to minimize or mitigate our contact with these forever chemicals versus how much we are paying for hospitalizations or for these adverse health impacts that we are experiencing? With that, if it pleases the chair, I'd like to defer to Ms. Miller.
We can ask Ms. Miller if she has comments on those questions. And I do see Deputy Commissioner Keeneman back there vigorously nodding her head at some of the comments. And so I might offer her an opportunity to come up in a moment as well. Ms. Miller?
Yes, thank you. And through the chair, Representative Story, we are very concerned and don't support the use of thermal remediation, also known as incineration, for PFAS because it's not effective at completely breaking the bonds of the carbon-fluorine structure of PFAS. So we've done quite a lot of analysis of the PFAS incinerator that's in Moose Creek up north, and we have looked at the levels of PFAS in the treated soils after they went through the thermal remediation, and we found significant levels of PFAS in the residue in the treated soils. Furthermore, incineration really only carries the problem further and can expose surrounding communities to higher levels of PFAS through inhalation through air currents. So this to us is really a false solution. I think there are some very good technologies that are coming along and proven to destroy PFAS, including supercritical water oxidation. These are non-incineration technologies, non-combustion technologies, because we really want to break those PFAS bonds down completely, and incineration does not do that. And I do think that we are exposing communities in the surrounding area of incinerators to unsafe levels of these PFAS chemicals.
Thank you, Ms. Miller.
Thank you.
And we have probably the final question for today from Representative Hemshute. And then, as I mentioned, we may offer an opportunity for our deputy commissioner to come up as well. Representative Hemshute.
Thank you, through the chair. I might actually want to go straight to the deputy commissioner. I have questions for DEC.
While Ms. Kieneman is joining us, I just wanted to note we did have another bill noticed for today, and I don't believe we will get to that today. So I just want to thank Representative Jimmy for joining us, and we will take up House Bill 213 at our next hearing where we take up bills. Thank you, Representative Jimmy. Ms. Kieneman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. If it pleases the committee, I may want to spend a couple minutes outlining the good work that we do at DEC. I should say, for the record, Crystal Kieneman, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Environmental Conservation. If I may take a couple minutes to outline the good work we do, how the 2024 EPA drinking water rule is currently being implemented by our department, as well as some of the assumptions and potential challenges that we are working through regarding this legislation to ensure that we, upon passage, right, we at DEC would be implementing the legislature's will and have a better understanding of that. So we currently in Alaska, we don't have any manufacturers of a manufacturing source of PFAS. The substances that are present are due to the use of consumer and industrial products. Based on available data, PFAS exceedances in Alaska are limited and site-specific. I do understand the map up there. It can look scary, and I understand that. But when we are talking about PFAS, especially in our public drinking water systems, there are more site-specific as opposed to widespread exceedances. So we are currently focused on identifying and assessing the risks to drinking water and supporting public water systems. In alignment with the 2024 EPA drinking water rule, we have paid for and sampled 366 of Alaska's 612 public water systems using federal grant funding. I want to mention that to date, only 3% of the systems currently tested have exceeded that maximum containment level of that is outlined for PFOA and PFAS of 4 parts per trillion. None of the systems have exceeded that hazard index for, as mentioned by the sponsor, for PFAS mixtures. Additionally, no maximum containment level or MCLs have been identified in non-transient, non-community systems such as schools or office buildings, as well as no exceedances have been identified in 129 of 165 of our native village community water systems to date. And the remaining systems in those villages are expected to be tested in the near future. We also established within DEC in-state laboratory capacity to conduct this PFAS analysis and are working directly with those systems as required under our drinking water primacy to ensure that appropriate follow-up actions when exceedances are identified. We continue to monitor available treatment and cleanup technologies for drinking water. These include granular activated carbon or GAC systems, as well as ion exchange resins. Again, this is an emerging contaminant. It took us many years to get to this point, right? We all use nonstick pans. We all have, we believe this was okay until we learned better, until the science came out and showed the true impacts of this. Again, Representative Holland mentioned thermal remediation. In contaminated soil, thermal remediation has shown promise for the destruction of PFAS within that contaminated soil. But I do want to, when it comes to the air monitoring and the thermal remediation, Representative Holland, I know you are keenly interested in that world. The bill references Title V permitting requirements in a way that does not currently align with how our federal program is structured. The federal program does not establish permit thresholds of this type of that's contemplated in this legislation and may create additional ambiguities for our department as we implement that outside of primacy. We are also monitoring during the thermal remediation on our test sites that we have, especially at JBER. We believe our current approach is already achieving the intended result of this legislation. Our permits for these facilities require annual testing, and our department and our staff is on site during those testing events. The bill adjusts inspection frequency under those Title V permits, and our current practice is already more frequent, as well as operation-based oversight. Going into the more fiscal side of the house, and I understand time, but some of these points are very important on what we are doing and how this impacts our department. There are currently just over 1,300 public water systems in Alaska that provide water to both residents and visitors. This bill requires testing of all of those systems by DEC. Currently, under our drinking water primacy program, we are only required to test and oversee about half of those water systems. So our current grant funding that we receive will cover half of the testing, but there is additional testing that is outside of our current primacy program. And those are for the transient non-community water systems that provide water, such as gas stations, campgrounds, where people don't remain for long periods of time. I also want to mention that nothing in this bill requires testing of individual drinking water wells. So our department would be only testing public water systems. If there is a release, so that would be under 1A of the bill, if there is a release through our contaminated site division, we would go through, identify that, and then there would be continued testing as is our current practice within contaminated sites. But by doubling our testing, it substantially increases our operational responsibilities, staffing, laboratory needs. When it comes to providing alternate drinking water for when PFAS levels exceed statutory limits, this would require, back to Representative Story's question about emergencies and when do we activate for that under this legislation, it would require immediate provisions of that bottled water. Currently, we work with operators and the systems when it comes to any exceedances, and the responsible party or the water operator provides that alternative drinking water. This bill would require DEC to immediately provide that water. On average, the cost for providing drinking water per person per year is about $700. So depending on the size of the community, the size of the number of people who utilize those systems, that number can escalate, hence the large capital cost within one of our fiscal notes. I do want to address in the sponsor statement It states that neither the state nor the communities being affected by PFAS contamination will bear the financial burden for a situation they did not create under this bill. And again, current law outlines that the responsible party is the one who provides that drinking water. Under this bill, the department would provide it. It also creates a new liability defense for parties. If a party can demonstrate compliance with applicable laws, regulations, manufacturer instructions, they may be held responsible, as they should. But in many cases, especially for older releases, and we find this with our work through our spill prevention and response and contaminated sites, trying to identify where that spill comes from and who that responsible party can take time. And under this legislation, we at the department would be responsible for providing drinking water up to and until a responsible party is identified. If the responsible party has followed all applicable laws and regulations, then it goes to the manufacturer. Once with PFAS, normal compounds have kind of a barcode identifier within that compound. PFAS does not. So trying to trace that PFAS back to individual manufacturers is very challenging. We can trace supply chain and airports, right, where that who may have bought it where, but trying to tie it to an actual manufacturer is very complicated. And then that pulls us into, if it is manufacturer-based, we would go into multi-district litigation. Again, you're talking national cases. Many states would be involved in this litigation, and we are not guaranteed full reimbursable costs back to us to offset either the system upgrades, bottled water. So there will be, as much as we like to try, especially through reimbursement from responsible parties, it is never a one-to-one. And especially with this, it would be very, very challenging for us to be able to recoup all of the costs associated with the work that we will be doing.
So, Deputy Commissioner, we're gonna have to adjourn for today, but we will be bringing back House Bill 235. And I just want to thank you for speaking. Especially want to thank the bill sponsor and invited testimony, as well as our public testimony today. And again, we will be bringing back House Bill 235 at our next hearing, where we take up legislation. So that'll be next Tuesday. So this concludes our business for today. Our next meeting is on Thursday, March 26th at 3:15 here in room 120. At that hearing, we are taking a break from legislation for a day, which should probably be a good news for members. We have a presentation, several presentations on broadband deployment in Alaska. Testifiers include the Alaska Broadband Office, GCI, ACS, Pacific Dataport, which manages Starlink, and Tanana Chiefs Conference. And with no further business before the committee, actually, one other thing. We are having a meeting on Saturday. It is covering two bills, and they're both on daylight savings time. And
one's on standard time.
One is on, regardless.
Just saying.
Same suite of issues. We'll cover those two bills on Saturday. And with nothing else before us, we are adjourned at 5:11 p.m.